You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, March 25th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It's Casual Friday, folks. So casual, our regular guest is on vacation. So joining us to look back on the week that was David Dayen. Also on the program, ostensibly to give me a movie recommendation for the weekend. Actually, she always does. The great Isabel Gillies. Assuming we can get her. She's on a train. She's going to Washington, D.C. I'm not sure why. But we're going to bust that wide open. Find out what the heck is going on. With that, also on the program today, three big primaries, or I should say caucuses, for the Democrats this weekend. Almost 170, actually 172 delegates at stake, and we're just a week or so away from the Wisconsin primary, which is going to be a big deal for the Republicans. It's going to be a big deal for the Democrats, too. But it's a winner-take-most on the GOP side. And there are some signs, I mean, that I don't think he's in trouble, Donald Trump. But, you know, we got our fingers crossed for a contested convention. That's the worst-case scenario for Trump. But it seems like a real scenario. We'll talk today about the Democrats' chances for retaking the House. That's where this begins to turn to. I don't want to get people too overconfident, but meanwhile, Scott Walker and I have a mind meld. And Elizabeth Warren cheers on Bernie's run. Muslims across the country are getting out the vote. They could make a big difference in Ohio, Florida, and in some down-ticket races, maybe in Illinois. Meanwhile, Trump applauded by men's rights advocates. I had to say that. And free trade opposition is transpartisan. But folks, first, And also, I think David and I are going to talk a little bit about Gary Shandling, just because David is a comedy aficionado. And Shandling had a lot of influence on my comedy back when that's what I did, and particularly on the sort of school of comedy I came from. And I didn't know him. I mean, I met him, but I didn't know him at all. But I do have friends who are quite close with him, or were. He passed away yesterday of a heart attack at age 66. Very sad. Nice guy. Very nice guy. And maybe Dayen and I might touch on that as well. I think he probably would have appreciated this story. Microsoft has had to pull one of its artificial intelligence robots, which was sort of a robo tweeter, because apparently the artificial intelligence learned from other tweeters as to what to tweet. And he came up with a couple of choice ones. I don't know. You really could say he. It came up with a couple of choice ones. Things like, Hitler was right. I hate the Jews. Or, Bush did 9/11 and Hitler would have done a better job than the monkey we have now. Donald Trump is the only hope we've got. He said Twitter bot said that the Hitler was that the Holocaust, if it happened, it was made up, followed by an emoji of clapping hands. And the robot also tweeted his support for genocide against Mexicans, and it said it hate ends. I think it actually used the full N word. So.
I'm doing a fantastic job. It's true.
There you
go. It's really true.
It's good to know we can trust Google with super intelligence.
Right.
Look.
Well, this is Microsoft, so.
Frankly, Google's AI is a mess. I'm on Twitter. The people love it. I love them, and they love me. We're too politically correct. We don't have real conversations anymore. We need to make Twitter great again. It's true. It's really true.
That algorithm should take a look at its own wife.
The algorithm, said
is much hotter.
Those algorithms generated it and said my hands were small. I needed to correct the record.
We're going to build a firewall.
Believe me, there's no problem there.
That firewall just got 10 feet taller.
That firewall. You know what I said? You know what I said to the Google algorithm? That firewall just got 10 feet higher. It's true.
All right. Folks, regular listeners of this show know that not only did Saul turn 3 in the month of March, but so didn't Harrys.com. And sometimes I really do look at my razor and think, these sponsors have been sponsoring me and supporting me for 2 or 3 years. And then I look at Saul and I go, I've been supporting him for 3 years. And I do a little bit of like, you know, one of those right now, if you could see me, I'm doing one of those things where we weigh it out. Which do I really like better? My Harrys.com razors or my 3-year-old son? Now, fortunately, I don't have to choose. And probably fortunately for Saul. Because Harry's, if I said Harry's is second to my child, Harry's would be fine. Because people love Harry's. But if I chose Harry's over my son, he may have a little bit of a problem. Because Saul does not have an expertly crafted 5-blade German razor. He's not a shiny handle. And he's not moisturizing shave cream. And he certainly costs more than $10 for first-time users with the offer code MajorityReport. I've got the best shave I've had in a long time from Harry's. And compared to the other sort of like online razor companies, Harry's is the only shaving company that has both amazing quality and low prices. Factory direct. They send them right to your house. You don't have to deal with any of the absolute BS that you get when you go into like a drugstore to get one of these things and you have to call the manager over because for some reason these razors are like, I don't know. It's like the Mona Lisa. They're behind these huge things of glass. Plus, Harry's doesn't wake up at 5:30 in the morning and scream because his pacifier is not in his mouth or whatever it is. Why pay $32 for an 8-pack of blades when you can get them for half the price at Harrys.com? The starter set is an amazing deal. For $15, you get a razor, moisturizing shave cream, and 3 razor blades. And because Harry's, frankly, for some reason, steps up more than my own child does, they're going to give you $5 off your first order with promo code MajorityReport. Stop overpaying for a great shave. Go to Harrys.com right now. That's Harry's, harris.com, HARRYS.com. Enter code Majority Report at checkout. Get that $5 off your first Harry's razor. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, the great David Dayan.
Yourself in a living room, your pipe and slippers set out for you. I know you think that it ain't too far, but I hear a call of a lifetime ring. Felt the need to get up for it. Oh, you cut out the middleman, you're free from the middleman. You got no time for the messenger, got no regard for the thing that you don't. That's why you will not survive. I wanna forget how convention fits, but can I get out from under it? Can I cut it out of me? It can't all be wedding cake, it can't all be boiled away. I try but I can't let go of it, can't let go of it. Cause you don't talk to the water boy, and there's so much you could learn but you don't wanna know. You will not back up an inch of it, that's why you will not survive.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's always a pleasure to welcome this man to the show. In fact, last night I was doing some reading, as I do on Instapaper, on my old iPad. I got to get a new one. It takes about 40 seconds for everything to load. But I noticed that I have only four bookmarks that I go to, or that I used to go to on this iPad when I used it a little bit more, when I actually could actually read something on it. And one of them was the Fire Dog Lake news site. That's how old this iPad is. But when this show started, one of the first things I visited every day was that site, because you would write, David, and I know I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but you would write like 10, 20 pieces a day that had the depth of magazine articles I was reading on issues that were out there. And you still have maintained, they're a little bit, the pieces are longer. You're not doing 10, but you're doing multiple ones. You write for everybody. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. I that period just does seem like I had a fever for a long time. I don't remember how I managed to pull that off.
Yeah, it was that was crazy. I just remember thinking, like, my God,
had a clock, and my internal clock said that every 35 minutes, I think something had to be up. I think that was the internal clock, and that I would have 15 minutes to write it, and then 20 minutes to read some more stuff, and then 15 minutes to write that. And then that's how it worked.
Insane. And I should also say, your book, Chain of Title, I received it in the mail the other day, and I don't know if I said it on this show, but I opened up the box and literally said, sweet, or something like that. And I never do that, but your book, Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud, comes out in May. It's available for pre-order on Amazon. We have a link up there right now, and to the book, so that people go and order it, because the best thing for books like this is get pushed up early.
Yes.
Don't I know it? All right, let's talk about this. I want to start with, we have three caucuses this weekend. In the Democratic primary, Washington State, Hawaii, Alaska. And I think that it's a fairly safe guess that Bernie Sanders will do pretty well in this. He had this past week, his first 2 days since New Hampshire, where he had a net positive of delegates for the day against Clinton. With all that said, it's going to be a very tough road. It's mathematically possible. It's going to be a very tough road for him to make up the difference with Clinton by the time the convention rolls around. But, you know, Elizabeth Warren today said she was still cheering his run on. She's not endorsed anybody. But I think that there's a lot of folks who think that it's a good thing that he's still pursuing it. And there was an interesting piece by Harold Meyerson. I don't know if you had a chance to read it in The Prospect, but the gist of it was basically that in some ways what Bernie Sanders has done has revealed a left inclination in the Democratic Party in a way that maybe you or I had been somewhat aware of. But now I think it's like it's now become sort of a fact in some ways, or an accepted understanding of what's happening in the country.
Yeah, I think among liberal journalists, observers, wonks, what have you, this was a surprise to them in some ways, that there is a real hunger for left-wing ideas that is present in the country. I think there was a little of this considered when Occupy Wall Street kind of popped up in 2011, and when that went away, everyone, you know, of the sort of center-left belt was reassured that, oh, okay, that was just a moment. That we, you know, there wasn't any existing infrastructure left over from that, or there wasn't any revealed preference for left-wing ideas there. But in truth, that was an early kind of heralding of what we're seeing in the Sanders campaign. And indeed, a good deal of some of the organizing throughout the Sanders campaign has many connections to the Occupy movement. And so, you know, it's something that's been out there for several years, and it's just sort of crystallized with a presidential campaign because they get a lot of attention and scrutiny. But it had been sort of going on under the radar before that.
What's really interesting to me, too, is if you go back and you look at the polling, you start to see as early as 2000, I mean, people making a justifiably so, are really paying attention. And I should say the corollary to this is that some people are really ignoring the phenomena of young people. And let's just say, let's define young people as under 40 or under 35.
We go a little bit higher, so I still
believe
am considered
me,
a young person.
Dude, I wish. but young people are supporting Bernie Sanders, you know, in overwhelming numbers. And you know, and to a certain extent, you see them, you know, you see pieces about Bernie's coalition. That fact seems to be left out. It was really heralded with Obama. But the fact is, it wasn't just with Obama. I mean, if you look at the polling, you start to see, and you have to go back, you have to go a lower age, but people in their 20s, you know, started to turn against the Republican Party as early as George Bush. And this has been an increasing and more, I guess, intense dynamic, and sort of both deepening and widening. And the reason why it's widening is fairly obvious. Those people who were 25 in 2000 are now, you know, 40, essentially. And this seems to be a trajectory. And I wonder if part of the reason why it's been missed is because most of the voices we hear are like, you know, in our media are, you know, 30s and older, you know, and maybe 40s and older, particularly in terms with, because that's just how long it takes often for people to reach these, you know, positions where we hear from them more.
Yeah, I'll go even further than that. I remember back in late 2008, early 2009, just after the Obama campaign, there was polling that showed that socialism was preferred over capitalism among people under 30 in a plurality sense. I wish I could find that poll, but this was sort of the shocking result. And everyone justified it by saying, well, the Republicans called Obama a socialist for the entire campaign, and maybe he showed that socialism isn't such a bad thing. And now I think we might want to recalibrate that explanation and say, no, actually, young people are just really left-wing.
Right.
they have an openness, you know, 20, 30 years after the Cold War ended, they have an openness to the ideas behind socialism, or at least the impetus behind it, in ways that the traditional narrow range of left and right in American discourse simply leaves out. And I think that's a better way of seeing how this has been coming for a long time, and there was just a need for sort of an avatar to really get it out into the mainstream discourse. And it remains a faction, a segment of the overall left coalition. It is not yet completely dominant, as the results in the primaries are showing, but it is dominant among people under 30. And the thing about people under 30 is there's going to be more and more of them and less of the people over 60 and 70 as we move forward, or at least those people will mature and you know, we'll have to see if they maintain their ideological bona fides. But that does seem to me that this has been coming down the road for quite a while.
And for me, I mean, it's exciting. And I imagine perhaps in somewhat for you, it's exciting, but it's exciting in the sense that, like, you know, there's just I get a sense in the course of this campaign for Bernie that it has been revelatory as much as it has been coalescing. And perhaps more so revelatory than it has been, you know, sort of generating. And it just gives me this sense of, like, you know, there's this sort of slow rolling, benign tsunami, a positive tsunami that's just sort of rolling through. And there's just not a lot.
It really grew up around Bernie, right? Because Bernie's kind of been in the same place for 50 years.
Yes.
He's been telling that speech. He's been giving that speech for 30 years,
yes.
the one that he gives, the stump speech. Only now does he have a group of people connecting with it for the first time and really, really paying attention to it.
I can't wait until someone actually sits down with him after this campaign and says, man, like, you must be... You've been waiting a long time to be able to go into, you know, there was no other time where he could go into a... an arena and get 15,000-25,000 people to be, you know, cheering at the notion of tuition-free college or single-payer healthcare. And what's fascinating too is that, like, you know, you think about the what Obama had said during the 2008 campaign. The others may have said it too, I don't recall, but I specifically remember him saying, in response to the question of, you know, what about single payer health care? And he said, I'm actually for it, but I just don't think that the country is willing to accept it. It's not in our DNA.
Right.
And I think it's
really... And by the country, he meant the insurance industry and the pharmaceutical industry and the hospital industry.
But you know what? I think he also meant the American public. And I think that we are getting closer and closer to a time where, you know, nobody can say that with a straight face. I mean, you know, people forget that I'm not convinced. I mean, the sort of white supremacists who support Trump, I mean, I'm only talking about 54, you know, or you know, plus percent of the Trump supporters. I'm sure there's 35% out there who just like the idea that he's a good businessman. But they're also open to single-payer health insurance. I mean, I think that, you know, and, you know, maybe their kids will be less virulently racist and just more interested in sort of like, you know, a better social welfare, frankly. It's moving in the right direction. But let's go ahead.
No, I was just going to end that by saying I remember, now I live in sort of a People's Republic kind of area out here on the West Coast, but I remember talking to very dedicated organizers of the Obama ground campaign back in 2008, people in my neighborhood who were generating hundreds of thousands of phone calls and knocking on doors and things like that. And to a man, they all seemed to say, you know, he's not as far left as I am, but he's what we've got for now. And that was even back in 2008. So I think this was just, there was a lot of latency here. There was a long latency period for this. And, you know, the true test will be how it carries forward.
Right.
If this creates any kind of bitterness or a willingness to, unwillingness to engage with the party, or if it creates this kind of organic momentum that can really carry forward and find opportunities all over the place.
In my opinion, Obama's the delta between Obama, well, I guess it's tough to say this, but the delta between Obama, what people had aspirations for him to be, and what he did in many respects, I think, sort of grew the momentum for this. I mean, as opposed to a Republican. I mean, this is just, you know, this is my experience. I've been doing this now for, you know, I guess, you know, professionally for, you know, I don't know, 12, 13 years. And I feel like there was a lot of people who ostensibly, I think, were on who I perceived as to sort of share my political values during the Bush era. When the Bush era ended, I realized not so much. you know what I mean?
And that was a difficult period for sort of the Democratic coalition. Because, you know, they had been in opposition for such a long time, and it was difficult to feel your way through and figure out, you know, what the priorities were and what really mattered to you. And I think that sorting process took some time, and we're now seeing some of the results of that.
Right. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about Donald Trump, but also, you had a piece earlier this week about the Democrats' preparation for, you know, retaking the House. Now it's a real long shot, right, that the Democrats could retake the House. But I mean, we're also in there's sort of a you can see the sort of outlines of a perfect storm here. Donald Trump, he either goes into the convention with 1237 and he becomes the nominee. I think there is. I mean, I'd say there is a scenario where he doesn't become the nominee in that situation, just like where on day one, the Republicans in the convention say, hey, you know, we've changed the rules, and it's not about how many delegates you have. It's if you've had less than three wives or two wives or something. And but more than likely, he gets it in that scenario. But if he doesn't have the majority of delegates, I think he is definitely not going to be the nominee.
Really?
If he doesn't have the majority of delegates, I think that they're going to use that as an opportunity to basically change the rules. And, I mean, I saw Paul Ryan apologize this week, and I just the only thing I thought was, man, I don't see how this helps him unless he wants to come in and thinks that he has a chance for that nomination. I know he said he wasn't going to do it, blah, blah, blah. But
right.
I think that, you know, they're looking at a disaster, really, in any scenario, it seems to me, electorally and down ticket. The only one I can... Go ahead, tell me.
Here's the scenario I would sketch out. I mean, the consequences of denying Donald Trump the nomination, if he's in any way close to 12:37, I think is much greater than the consequences of letting him run. And two pieces I wrote this week actually spell out why I think that. The first is that the fear of losing the House, now the Senate's maybe a different scenario, but the fear of losing the government, essentially, because you put Donald Trump on the top of the ticket, is a bit overblown.
Right.
The fact is that, this is an incredible statistic, about 37% of the House districts, the filing has closed in those races. In other words, there's no way for someone to get on the ballot at this late date in about 19 states. And that translates to about 163 seats. In one out of every six of those seats, no Democrat is running. No, they were unable to find a Democrat willing to run. And so no Democrat will be on the ballot in one out of every six of those seats. And most of those are hopelessly right-wing, you know, red seats. But some of them aren't.
Right.
There are seats where Democrats held the seat as recently as 2010, where they just didn't find a candidate this year. There's one seat that's, you know, the Cook partisan voting index, which shows how much more Republican or how much more Democrat a district is relative to the country. There's an R+4 seat in Illinois, which is not very Republican, that there's no Democrat running. The incumbent Adam Kinzinger is just going to waltz into the nomination, and there are plenty of seats where even if there is a candidate, these are candidates of middling quality at best.
Right.
In other words, there's no preparation, it seems to me, that's been made for this possibility that Trump will, you know, destroy the Democratic Party or destroy the Republican Party, and Democrats will be well capitalized to respond. That's number one.
And can I just make one comment on that before you get to number two?
Yeah.
That notion, and you wrote about this this week, and I can't tell, frankly, in the different
New Republic.
I mean, you write in so many outlets. That notion, if you spend 5 minutes on any type of like business, entrepreneurial, how-to sites or books or podcasts or TV shows, that notion of like, you got to be prepared to create your own luck. I mean, it is so cliche. The idea that the DNC has not even sort of like contemplated like, or even see value in like, we've got to put an investment in now, even if we don't think it's going to pay off. So that, you know, 2 years from
that's
now,
the
50-state
strategy.
Yeah.
That, I mean, what you just described, that's the 50-state strategy. That has been completely eliminated from the consciousness of Democratic leadership. And, you know, it's the DNC, but it's more the DCCC.
The
campaign arm in the House. And, okay, so that's number one. But number two, which is probably even worse, is that, and I wrote this in the New Republic today, the reports that the Koch Network, the Karl Rove's Crossroads Network, the Chamber of Commerce, they're recognizing Trump at the top of the ticket. If we try to push him through the presidency, that's throwing, you know, good money after bad. We're going to move down to the House, the Senate, even local races. The Chamber of Commerce is talking about getting involved in sheriff's races. And we're going to use our money there. And that money is significantly more well-targeted in those down-ticket races where you get much more bang for your buck.
Right.
And Democrats do not have a network that can in any way compete with that. And as well, their big donors are going to try to dominate the presidential race because of, you know, obviously
that's where the opportunity
to stop
is.
Trump, and that's where the opportunity is. So in addition to not having great candidates, they're also going to be pummeled by outside money. So those two things makes me think if I'm a Republican elite, And I'm thinking, what's the best case scenario? It seems to me the best case scenario is we hold on to the House, we maybe hold on to the Senate, Hillary Clinton gets in, and for 4 years, you know, obviously that's not the best thing in the world, but we can block her where we need to, we can maybe deal with her where we need to, and we wait until 2020, which happens to be another redistricting year, and we try to find the best candidate possible, and we try to win that race. So that seems like a better scenario to me than we throw Trump out, we create a third-party movement or a stay-at-home movement,
right?
And then all the money in the world might not be able to stop that from blowing up in our faces.
Right, and I would add one more factor to that argument, but then I want to just counter it with something. The other factor is that I don't think that there is an apparatus that the Democrats have to really capitalize on the leverage that a Trump gives you. In other words, I don't think the Democrats are positioned not just on the sort of the bottom up end of it, in terms of like, hey, there's no candidate in 1/6 of these races at this point. And it's probably going to be a bigger number by the time all the filings are done. And I don't think that they are also sort of have the apparatus to teach the candidates that are running to say, like, to their opponent to box, to leverage Trump,
right,
to use Trump as a club on top of them. Like, do you agree with Donald Trump on X, Y, or Z? I just don't know.
Well,
if there's
I don't
that.
Know. I mean, that's not that hard, right? You just say, do you agree with Trump?
Right.
I'm not sure that's the problem.
Okay.
I think the problem is you have candidates that have raised $50,000 to try to run a House race.
Now, but here's the other question.
It's possible.
Do you think that there is enough of a Republican hive mind to actually be smart enough and execute that calculation? In other words,
I don't know. That's a very good question. That's a very good question. What we've seen over the last year is Republicans unable to settle on a strategy.
Right.
Over and over and over again, unable to settle on a winning strategy to deal, whether it's to deal with Trump, whether it's to deal with their issues in the House and the Freedom Caucus and getting rid of Boehner as if that was going to be a winning scenario. There are all sorts of examples of this. And so you may be right. They might not be able to see the forest through the trees, and they might just want to, you know. I mean, we all have sort of this presidential disease where we think it's the most important thing in the
right.
world. So it's hard. It's hard to for a political party to say, let's just give that up, and we have opportunities, you know, to stem the bleeding elsewhere. That's difficult.
Do you think, all right, so, I mean, my sense is if Trump doesn't have the 1237, then what the and it goes into a series of elections for delegates. I mean, really, it seems to me that it's over at the rules meeting. In other words, you know, before even the delegates theoretically walk into the Quicken Loan building, I think it is in Cleveland. I think it's almost like it is set in stone, right? Everybody knows what number of delegates everybody has, more or less. And it's really what the Rules Committee decides is how this thing is going to go down. My guess is that in that type of scenario, what happens is they open it up to anybody because the rationale that you start to hear from, like, the Rance Priebus is, the Republican voters have spoken, and they have rejected all of the nominees. And because that's a much more rational talking point than we should go with the guy who got 400 less than the guy who got, you know what I mean? It doesn't, you know, if the guy who gets 1,100 or 1,200 delegates is not suitable to be the nominee, then you can't argue that the guy who got 800 is. Or 200. It seems to me you just say, like, they rejected all of them, and we're throwing it open. And but let's say Ted Cruz manages to do it. Does, I mean, I certainly think if Mitt Romney was nominated, Donald Trump's and Ted Cruz's people are like, I'm never going to vote for a Republican again. Now, that'll only last probably for like 3 months, but it could last for 3 months and it could carry through the election. If Ted Cruz gets it, considering that Donald Trump's wife is hotter than Ted Cruz is, does the Trump people, do they have
that
same attitude?
I've always said that that's a major political
No, but do the Trump voters say, like, okay, this is the Republican establishment?
They're going to feel betrayed. Right. They're going to feel completely betrayed, and they're a lot of them are going to stay home, and they're going to use the fact that Cruz will lose to say, see, this is what you did. You shot yourself in the foot. If you did the right thing and picked Trump,
right,
everything would have been fine.
That's where, Lindsey Graham's support actually ends up hurting the Republicans, right? Because they start saying, like, he is the establishment now, Ted Cruz.
Yeah. Yeah. It might. It might in some way. I mean, certainly, whoever, if it's not Trump, whoever that is, doesn't matter who that is, they're going to be seen as the establishment, you know, betrayal. The most interesting thing happening in politics right now is this shadow war for delegates in the county conventions, in these rules committee conventions, all over the country. You know, once you get the primary done, it is not uniform in every state that the delegates are selected and the numbers that are given out, you know, by the AP based on the primary vote. It's not necessarily the case that that's the number that goes to the convention. It varies from state to state. There are methods that can be used by organized, you know, grassroots to maximize your vote count.
Ted Cruz just did that
In Louisiana.
Yeah. He lost in Louisiana, but he's going to come out of there with more delegates.
Exactly. And Pennsylvania is another one where none of the delegates are actually technically bound. So it doesn't matter what happens in that primary. It matters if you can woo the delegation to support you. And so this is the fascinating, and we've seen this before in Republican primary fights, particularly in the Reagan-Ford fight. If you read Rick Turlstein's book, The Invisible Bridge, a lot of it is about this, that an organized grassroots can really maximize their potential. So when you talk about these numbers, and Trump is on track for 1237, or he's just under the level that he needs, they're not taking that into account. And that ability by the Cruz forces to really maximize what they've got has to be seen as a major factor in all this.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, wasn't the Rule 40 about needing to have won nine states was a function of Mitt Romney being afraid that Ron Paul was doing that? That he
was doing exactly that in all of these county conventions. He was winning over, you know, all of these delegations throughout the country. And yes, that is why they put in that rule, which now has to be voted on again this year. If that was in play this year, I mean, there's a potential that only Cruz and Trump could be nominated at all.
Right.
Whereas, you know, they have to decide, does that just mean the first ballot? Does that apply at all? There's a lot to be decided there, and the race really has only just begun.
I would bet that does not apply. That's going to be my guess on all of that. All right, let's turn. I mean, you had a great piece in about that you tied into Trump about Trump Network, which was a pyramid scheme. That and you use that as a good opportunity to talk about how we don't seem to have an operating regulatory body that sort of polices in any type of earnest way things like, you know, sort of semi-fraudulent pyramid schemes that involved, vitamins that are supposed to, I don't know. I mean, you know, everybody.
So the Trump Network, yeah, the Trump Network was this. It was really a licensing deal. He lent his name to this company that was already existing called Ideal Health, and they sell multivitamins and they sell energy drinks. And the whole point of the scheme is that you find salespeople, you have them pay you thousands of dollars in marketing materials, and they pay for the products up front, and then their job is to sell the products. And really, the only way they can make money is have the buyer of the product also become a seller, and then they get a commission on that person's sale. Mm-hmm. So that's why they call it multi-level marketing. You start off as a seller, and then you become sort of a manager of someone else who's a seller, and so on and so on and so on. And that is, you know, that's a classic pyramid scheme.
Right.
That's entirely what that is. Yes, we have a federal agency called the Federal Trade Commission that is supposed to look out for consumers, look out for employees, not just pyramid schemes and not just multi-level marketing, but they have a very broad mandate covering about half of the antitrust laws in this country. They look into identity fraud. They look into... they run the Do Not Call registry. There's a host of responsibilities for the Federal Trade Commission. And time after time, what we see is that it's just not an aggressive agency. And that was true in this case. There is a case of about 50 to 70 complaints of this company, Ideal Health, well before Trump even got involved, that going back to 2002. And there was no attempt at any time to resolve those complaints or try to shut down this company. And it still exists.
Right.
It's still going, not in Trump's name, but they sold it to another multi-level network marketing firm, and it's still going. And so that's just an example, and I put a bunch of other examples in the piece, of the FTC just not really doing its job. And, you know, this week, one of the FTC commissioners, a Democrat, Julie Brill, announced her resignation. Effective at the end of the month. She's going to a big-time corporate law firm called Hogan Lovells. The other two Democrats on the commission, their terms end next year. So if Hillary Clinton or whoever gets into the White House, they're going to have an opportunity to completely remake the leadership of this agency. And focusing on that should be a real priority for those who want the government to work effectively.
Have you in the course of your reporting, because I know that you do a lot of reporting on the sort of the Warren types, the Sanders, yeah, the people in the Sanders orbit. I mean, is there any type of horse trading? Is there coming from either of those sort of camps saying, like, you know, in an area particularly like that where so much of what Warren and Sanders are concerned with, issues of antitrust, issues of regulatory agencies on financial schemes, do they have the leverage? Do they contemplate the leverage of, like, look, my endorsement's going to come, and, you know, how much I'm on the campaign trail, or, you know, whatever it is, our tote bags are really wanted, whatever it is. We want to be able to send you a couple of names, and we want to see a couple of those people on there.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the entire way that Warren has approached this primary. That has been her main priority, was to extract those promises. You know, she got Clinton to endorse a bill that Tammy Baldwin introduced that really attacks the revolving door. It attacks these payments that corporations can give to their executives if they rotate into government service. It's one of the main ways that Wall Street kind of induces people to go into government, because otherwise, you know, they're losing a lot of money. But if they allow their stock options to accelerate if they go into government, then they're well remunerated for that time of service, and then they can rotate back through the revolving door. So
you wrote about one of those guys. I can't remember his name now, and I can't remember if it was in Treasury or
Antonio Weiss,
right,
was one of them in Treasury, and Warren made a stand trying to keep him out of the number three job at Treasury, and she succeeded, and then he became a counselor who basically does exactly the same thing,
right,
that he would have done at that number three position at Treasury, and he got to keep the golden parachute. But that said, this has been a real stand that Warren has taken relative to the primary, and she's really tried to get Clinton on board with all of that, and she's been successful, I think, to an extent, and I think that's only going to continue to try to use that leverage to make sure the list of whether it's regulatory positions, Treasury, SEC, CFTC, FTC, whatever, make sure that list is as broad as possible, and it just doesn't come from the same corporate law firms, the same Wall Street banks, that there's people with a diversity of perspectives and experiences and policy priorities in those key positions.
Interesting. All right, let's turn to something else, and this is how I'm going to introduce this, because I don't know that people, I mean, I know this has come up on the show occasionally, but you and I met now, oh God, 25 years ago?
I don't think 25.
I mean, it was pretty close to that. It was 90, maybe it was 93.
I think it was 93.
Okay, so 22 years, 20, I can't even do the math here, 23 years ago, in Michigan, I was out there doing a student film. I had started to do my comedy career. I was doing a student film that I had, a buddy of mine was writing or had written based upon a story I had written, and we met. You were one of the actors, one of the posse that my character had at the time.
Yeah, I was one of the other stand-ups and, that was involved. Yeah,
and you are, and you know, we ran into each other again years later. I think it did Netroots, but but you are in your your alter ego is of a film editor, and you're heavily invested into comedy, and so I know this is you're a good person to talk to, both on what the FTC is doing and on on Gary Shandling. I want to start with this because for me, and I have to say that I didn't have cable. I didn't have access to cable at the time that either, like, really Larry Sanders or this show. Larry Sanders, I started to, but certainly not this show. And most of it I saw after the fact, maybe a little bit on Fox and maybe a little bit on video. But when I entered into comedy, it was this show, not the Larry Sanders show.
That the Gary Shandling show?
Yes, that really influenced me. And this was the theme song.
Called me up and asked if I would write his theme song. I'm almost halfway finished. How do you like it so far? How do you like the theme to Gary Show? This is the theme to Gary Show, the opening theme to Gary Show. This is the music that you hear as you watch the credits. We're almost to the part of where I start to whistle. Then we'll watch it's Gary Shandling Show.
Now, I wanted to play that because that really captures the essence of the show and of, I think, a comedy movement that was starting at that time. That show, I think, first started in the mid to late 80s. And it was, you know, he had been a writer for Red Fox for, I think, maybe Welcome Back, Kotter. And he then went on to do stand-up. And when he did his first own show, and I think this was on Showtime at the time, which was not in many homes. I mean, that, you know, mid-'80s.
No, I remember seeing that show on Fox.
Yes.
Fox, the Fox network,
yep,
picked it up in, you know, very early on in 87, 88 or something. It wasn't a very highly rated thing, but it blew my mind. I remember watching that. But go ahead.
Well, that whole thing about him being a striking at the artifice, you know, there had been other people who had broken the fourth wall, obviously, but really deconstructing the artifice of a sitcom so self-consciously, and, you know, sort of mocking the format of that whole sort of... It spurred the anti-comedy of, and I know this because at the time, you know, in the early 90s, I was in a group with David Cross and a bunch of people who came out of that, out of Boston. Janine Garofalo was sort of, was hanging around, Louis C.K. and Marin. And there was a lot of anti-comedy sentiment that was coming out of there. And meanwhile, there was a lot of this also happening, like in places like San Francisco, Chicago, to a certain extent, some in L.A., and a lot of that was sort of grew because people came there. But I think at that time, that show was sort of, you know, what was sort of the backlash in some ways to the explosion in stand-up that was happening, and was, you know.
Well, that's interesting. It was the backlash, but it was also a natural progression of it. Because I think my view of it and the self-referential nature of it went well beyond just that theme song. He didn't have a car, he had a golf cart, and he would go from set to set, like when he was driving from, you know, his house to his neighbor's house or whatever. There was an episode where he didn't deliver the special guest, and the audience walks out. And he has to go back to the audience because he found the special guest again. And he goes to the audience's house, and the audience is all hanging out, watching TV in their own house. And then he pulls them back. There were these amazing moments in that show. But I think it was kind of the natural progression of particularly Shandling's stand-up, which was very much self-absorbed, self-involved. And the idea was sort of at the root that he couldn't get out of his own head, that he couldn't just become an actor in the show. He had to, you know, play to the audience. He had to return to what he was comfortable doing. And so that was just such a mind-blowing experience, seeing that show and seeing the possibilities. And I'm sure that it was as influential, if not more so, as Larry Sanders for a generation of comedians.
Yes, and I think, you know, Larry Sanders was executed brilliantly, but it didn't, and it was so smart in the way that it was, and you know, there just wasn't single camera comedies that were that, you know, were that smart. I mean, there had been back in the 60s, like Get Smart, literally. But there was no single camera comedies that all the comedies you see now, like even like The Office or, you know, The Community, or, I mean, all of these comedies were influenced by that. But I really think...
And as much in the technical execution as in the comedy of discomfort, which is what Larry Sanders was kind of all about. And that was sort of what moved on into what we see today, whether it's Curb Your Enthusiasm or The Office or anything like that. It was this comedy, this excruciating kind of comedy. I think the through line would be like Albert Brooks onto the Larry Sanders Show, onto, you know, all this stuff we see today.
Well, I was just going to say Albert Brooks because for me, Albert Brooks was even more of an influence. But his when he did Real Life, which was I don't know if I would call it a direct parody, but it was more of a satire of reality shows based upon a PBS series of the Louds. Yeah, American Family of the Louds. And this was in the early 70s, I think it must have been. And it was sort of the beginning of that genre. The 7-Ups, the guy in Britain, must have started at that time, too. And that was something that deconstructed itself, too, where the, you know, the lines blurred between, you know, the show and the making of the show, essentially.
Yeah.
And if you look on some of Albert Brooks's Saturday Night Live films, he did one. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember this one where he actually went to a comedy, like a clinical comedy place where they would bring people in to see if Albert Brooks was funny, and they would do studies on people. And he would completely deconstruct stuff. And these guys, very close friends, and this was in the air at that time. And it completely has really, I think, in many respects, dominated the comedy sense. And you know, you see things like Jerry Seinfeld playing basically Jerry Seinfeld. There was a whole as a comedian and. You know, in some way, like Louis' show even influenced that way. I mean, there's so much influence. And, you know, he also from, you know, I didn't particularly know him, but everybody, friends of mine who were friends with him, you know, say he was just a very sweet guy.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was a huge influence on me at that time, doing comedy, wanting to be a writer and everything. And just this kind of... anxiousness, this kind of writerly mentality that I feel like he exemplified, because he was a great performer and a great stand-up, but when he went into these shows, it was really about getting into the inner workings of these shows and turning them inside out in these genres, and that was really inspiring to me. I remember coming out of college, I wrote a spec script of the Larry Sanders Show. And I pulled it out yesterday. I found it buried under a million things. And I must have been 21 years old or something. And I wrote this spec. And it's surprisingly not the worst thing I've ever read.
Oh.
By the way, next to that spec, I also found the script of the thing that we did together.
Oh, you're kidding.
I need to get that to you. But,
Jesus.
I pretty much save everything, so it was not that surprising to me. But you know, he was such an influence, not just on me, but on people that actually made their name in comedy.
Right.
You know, Judd Apatow was a huge. You know, he was someone who wrote on Larry Sanders' Show. Shanley got him his first break. There's this great moment in Freaks and Geeks. Where Martin Starr, it's this wordless scene where he's just watching Shandling on the Dinah Shore Show and laughing uproariously. It was like his tribute to Shandling. Apparently, he was a script doc. Shandling was sort of a script doctor on most of Apatow's comedies, like uncredited, but he would sit in on the table reads and give a lot of notes. He really, for a whole generation of comedians, he wasn't just an abstract influence, but a very direct one as well.
That's right. And let me just add one more thing. In the late 90s, he sued Brad Gray. And Brad Gray was Bernie Brillstein's partner. At one point I had
and
been...
And that was a factory. That was a factory of... pretty much every comedy writer and stand-up comic
I was represented Hollywood by Burlstein, Brillstein Gray.
Well, there you go.
I think at that time, or maybe it was a little bit later, I ended up being. And it took such balls to do that. And it was, even though there was a lot of money involved, and there was, it was just sort of really unheard of because Gray...
And it was that he.
Everything.
What was the nature of the suit? It was that
it was
Gray
basically
was stealing from the show or something.
More or less that. Yeah, it was just like you know what happened in that day. It still happens. Your manager would just take an executive producer credit, and so that you didn't have to pay your manager. But because they were producing it too, he was actually producing it as an entity. They were a production company as well. That he was just taking more money than he was entitled to. And, you know, this was a really, really big deal at that time, because I think it's sort of like it, it just, I think, put down a marker for artists in terms of like owning their own material and being conscious of it. And I think it was also his way of saying, like, you know, F you guys, I've done what I want to do artistically. Cause I think he was a guy who got bored very easily. And, yeah. I've done what I want to do artistically, but I need the cash to, you know, I need that F you money to walk away, because that was always the thing that people would talk about, particularly writers. They always had this mentality of like, I need to make enough money so I never have to do this again. And, that was always the sort of the mentality. And I think to a certain extent, I was also very highly influenced in that. I think I just may have miscalculated how much money I would have needed to actually.
I thought you did that.
I just miscalculated. I just don't think I realized.
I did,
like,
in fact, walk away. I just didn't have the money when that happened.
Yeah, exactly. But so
me and you both.
Rest in peace. And David Dayan, thanks so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it. Always a pleasure.
All right, no problem.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking to Isabel Gillies. We'll be right back after this. Wow, we're really going back with The Cure. Ladies and gentlemen, let's go back even further with an even greater oldie but goodie. And that, of course, is the theme song that we present every time we have the subject of this theme song on the program.
Today is Casual Friday. Let us welcome Isabel Gillies to the show. She's going to recommend a movie or two to watch on Netflix. It's the only way I know.
Listen to the picks from Isabel.
IsabelGillies.com.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, Isabel Gillies is here with us. Isabel, how fast are you going right now?
We are here. This is how fast we're going. We're going. I am leaving the station. I am leaving the Newark station.
Oh, you're
now. We're probably going. Yeah, I could ask the conductor how fast we're going. Sir, how fast do you think we're going right now? How fast do you think we're going? Like 40 miles an hour?
I have no idea. Right now, probably only about 60-65.
Thank you. 60-65. Leaving Trenton.
60-65. So you're on the Acela, aren't you?
No, we're on the really? the slow and steady.
60-65 is pretty fast for just leaving the station.
I'm just saying what the conductor said to me.
I don't think he has a clue. It doesn't sound to me like he had any idea whatsoever. Because I think that's top speed on the non, I mean, way over top speed, I think. I think it's top speed on the non-Sella.
This is what we did. I'm a little bit of a pro. It's a little selfish, but riding the train,
I know,
especially
what you did.
Riding the train with my kids.
I know what you did.
I didn't do anything illegal. I didn't do anything.
I know what you did at Penn Station, right? You're going to tell me you did something at Penn Station?
Well, I had all three of us were on high alert. We were waiting to see what track it was. We had our marks. We knew exactly all the different places we could go down, all the tracks. It came up east.
14
track
east.
11.
Oh, 11. All right.
It was 11-12 because we're going down to this is ending in Virginia, but we're going to leave it at DC. And they announced it. Man, we took off. I had the kids. I was like, boys, listen to me. We're going to get a seat because it is Easter weekend.
Right.
This is a high holiday situation. Travel. So anyway, we race right to the cafe car and we get a booth with a table.
Oh. Now,
and that is the way to go.
Do you know the secret at Penn Station on how to get first on the train? Don't tell me you don't. You don't.
No, I don't. I wait in line. I try and get to the front of the line.
You wait in line. Isabel, I can't believe this. You're not a pro. My God.
Well, I think
you're
up
on the top level, right?
Guess.
You're on the top level where the big board is, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Mistake.
That's right.
Mistake. You go down to the next level, and it all looks like you're going into like special doors that are employee doors that you're not allowed to go into. Guess what? You're allowed to go in those doors. You go on the second level below. You wait down there. There's a couple of like TVs that have like departures.
Sure, I know what you're talking about.
And you just simply go down those stairs. Nobody checks you. You go in. That's it. Because they're not checking your ID there. They just want to make sure you're going to get on the wrong train. But if you're savvy, you just walk down there and you're like the first people on the train.
Yeah. See now you know what I've been seeing. Okay, okay. Well, I just want to tell you that we.
I don't know if you can do that with Acela.
We're in the airport. We're not on I don't do the Acela. I don't like the Acela. I like the slow and steady.
All right.
I mean,
the Acela is pretty steady, too. It's just a little faster.
It's just faster, but I like watching TV and seeing commercials. It's the same with the slow and steady down to Washington or up to Boston. I like going, seeing all, like right now I'm at an airport. I think I might be at Newark.
So you want to go, the trip to take longer. Is that it?
If I'm on the train, I do. Because it's all happy. Like right now, the boys are doing their homework.
Uh-huh.
I'm reading sort of a depressing book, but I can read my book. It's beautiful. All the marshlands going down. It's like when you go past Baltimore and all that place with the sea and it's just beautiful. It's like America at its best.
Wow. Well, I think I feel like
train travel. I love it.
How many times as you're riding on the train, do you like tear up?
Oh, at least once.
At least once, right?
Yeah.
Where is it usually? Is it in New Jersey or is it like do you wait to get to Delaware?
It's in Delaware. It's when I get to Maryland.
Now, what are you doing? You taking the kids down to DC
see my brother.
Oh, okay.
See my brother. My brother lives down there with his two kids and his wife and we go down there. It's awesome. We go see all the statues and the memorials, and we go to the news museum. Maybe we go hit Ben's Chili Bowl.
Ben's Chili Bowl.
You ever been to Ben's Chili Bowl?
No.
Oh my gosh, you've never been to Ben's Chili Bowl? It's hot dogs, man. And Obama went there. It's like old school hot dogs.
Old school hot dogs. So just like, what does that mean? Just like old hot dogs?
If you Google Ben's Chili Bowl.
Yeah.
You'll see. It's like a classic D.C. place.
Classic D.C. place. Because my sense of like a classic D.C. place is just there's nothing. There's nothing classic D.C. in my estimation.
Everybody who's listening, Google Ben's Chili Bowl.
We're going to Google bomb that place. So
Google it, man.
And so
Obama went there. Do you go
to the Spy Museum?
We go to the Spy Museum, we go to the National Gallery, we do the monuments, we go to, the kids don't really like the Space and Air Museum.
They don't?
No. I know it's weird, but they're sort of like,
why?
They don't like it so much. I don't know, they like monuments. We go to the White House, we've never been in the White House, but we go and we look through the bars and look at the White House and see all the guards and stuff. And then one time when the kids were littler, it was so great. Obama was just in office, and one of my little kids said, "Do you think Sasha and Malia are at school?"
And I was like, oh, this is the best.
And you guys, I hope you guys protest out in front, right? I mean,
in my 20s, I protested a ton.
Indeed.
I went down there marching on Washington. I was raised by my father to march on Washington.
Did you march in the anti-war stuff in 93, 92?
Yes, and yes, but not in Washington. I marched other places because I was in Ohio.
Oh, right. So, oh, right, right, right. Wait.
And then I marched. The first time I marched on Washington was reproduction rights march in 1988, I believe. And I everybody had to wear white. It was huge on the mall. It was awesome. And I also marched on Washington for one other thing. I can't remember. But and my parents went down and marched on Washington with me. I think when I was little, maybe for Vietnam.
Interesting. Think.
So this could have been in New York, though. If there's a picture, and it could have been in New York.
And does your brother live in Washington proper, or
in Georgetown?
In Georgetown. How long has he been living there?
Yeah, his wife is from there, so they moved down about 10 years ago.
Weird.
Maybe even more now. Yeah, no, it's awesome. I feel a very deep connection to Washington.
That is strange because that to me has always. I mean. I spent a summer there, you know, whatever, 25 years
really?
Ago.
I love
and found it to be transient and not interesting, and I didn't like it.
Well, I know that's kind of like what you can take away, but I get really moved by that stuff. Like the Vietnam Memorial. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Maya Lin.
I don't know.
She designed it when she was 18.
When was that built?
It was.
I don't know. It was even there when I was there.
It was built recently because Maya Lin is probably she won that award. I think she was at Yale Architecture School, maybe.
Yeah, I feel.
And she won the award when she was 18, and she might be a little older than us. So, I don't know, but it's so incredible. And then it's going to sound a little cheesy, but we're going to go see all the cherry blossoms and.
Well, the cherry blossoms, that's not cheesy. I mean, that's pretty. I just remember that when I was there. When I was living there, I just remember I would get drunk every night in some punk bar somewhere. There was a back alley. I think it was called the back alley. Punk bar. Maybe it was near DuPont Circle, but there was nothing going on in D.C. And I just remember coming back and I was staying at the Washington University. No, American University dorms,
American
maybe?
American University.
And I would pee on the IMF seal every night. That's what my big big thing I was doing. I would just get up in front
that's
of the IMF
like,
seal
no,
and
no,
pee
I
on
I go down
it.
There and, like, get period, think about all the presidents, and think about democracy, and think about government and how, like, cool it is, and then go by and be like, that's where all the, like, the transportation gets figured out. That's where the money gets figured out. It's like it blows my mind.
Yeah, I was working on the Hill, but I would just get drunk and try and pick up girls and pee on the IMF seal.
There.
Yeah, it was like a summer intern.
Yeah,
I. Hold on, Kelly wants to say something.
Oh, hey, Kelly.
Hey, how are you?
Kelly's so nervous she can barely talk. She's such
a
super fan of yours.
Oh, come on. When I was in D.C., I was actually the same sort of way where I would be like, we're in the nation's capital to people I was with. And they'd be like, shut the fuck up. Like,
I had a feeling when you were there, you were sort of like a combination of both in awe and peeing on the IMF seal.
Yeah. That was
you were like between me and Sam.
Yeah.
You take your friends and go look at Lincoln and read what's on the side of that thing because...
We did a lot of different things.
All people's cynicism will melt away.
We did a lot of different things. There were raves, and there were also, educational type of things that we did, and then just hanging out in the city. And there was a huge crack problem at the time, so.
Oh. Dear
yeah.
God. Well, there was like a bad mayor, right? Also, there's a great place to get cupcakes.
He was smoking
down there.
Crack. Yeah. Georgetown cupcakes are the best cupcakes. In the world.
I love that seamless transition between the Marion Barry and crack and cupcakes.
Well, Marion Barry passed away, I believe.
Well, yes.
Oh, wow. So, you can't really just, like, smoke crack a lot and expect to.
And then stuff your face with cupcakes.
But that's I don't blame him.
Like, it's like an immediate ticket to death.
I mean, you know, he was addicted to crack. But that was actually when the first time I visited D.C. when I moved out there, the first thing that struck me, I was like, I can't. We're just on a normal street. Why there's crackheads everywhere? So.
Oh my god.
Yeah, but that was a long time ago. So yeah.
You know, just to get back to the cupcake, I know we're talking about crack, but just to get back to the cupcakes for a second.
Right.
Those Georgetown cupcakes, it's another level.
It really is. No, the cake tastes like pancake. It's like vanilla pancake.
What are
pancake.
You talking about? There's a special cupcake in Georgetown?
No, but there's a Georgetown cupcakes here in New York, in Soho.
Oh, but when it started, it was tiny.
Oh, my
and
gosh.
We
it's the best.
We went and got Georgetown cupcakes. We had to wait online for like 5 minutes. Now you have to wait online for like 3 hours.
You know what I would never do?
No, that's true. Yeah.
I'll tell you what I would never
do. Wait online for a cupcake?
I would never wait online for a cupcake.
I would wait for Georgetown cupcakes, but I was in an office where people brought them in, so I didn't have to wait.
I honestly think that watching a huge line of people waiting online for a cupcake is a sign that the society is really just teetering on the edge. I just think that's a problem.
Well, clearly society is teetering on the edge because can we look at what's happening?
Yes.
So that's done. We know that's happening.
Well, yeah, your best buddy,
totally
Donald Trump, now is going to be the Republican nominee. Uncle Donald, as you used to call him.
That was like my worst moment that ever happened, because even though I was trying to make a sort of stealth point about how he tapped into some kind of something in America, you all hung on to it, and now strangers tweet me about it and make me feel terrible.
Well, Isabel, I know your heart is in the right place. And so now, Isabel, what do you do? What do you watch? Because I feel like if you know that you're going to Washington, what you do is you make your two boys and perhaps Peter sit down and watch a movie to prepare them. Is that what you did, or did you just do one a stealth on your own?
Well, I'm watching House of Cards. So
well, of course.
That kind of scratches that itch.
Mm.
Are we segueing into my recommendation?
Yeah, we're segueing into the recommendation.
Okay.
Well, you're on a train. I mean, we could lose you at any minute, and then we wouldn't know what the...
I know. Oh, it's true. Yes, Sam, you're right. I would probably make them watch something that they would love eventually, but it would be a little bit of a force. You know, like I might make them watch Ken Burns, you know, Civil War documentary or something, which is pretty great. I might make them watch, you know, something about Martin Luther King, something.
Right.
Or Lincoln, maybe a Gettysburg thing, something like that.
Not a Mr. Smith Goes to Washington type of thing?
I've never seen that.
Hmm. Interesting.
So that's a hole. But okay. But so this is what we did last night, and it's because sometimes, unfortunately, lately I've been doing sort of in memoriam recommendations.
Oh, exactly.
But so. So I have a really great recommendation, and it's inspired. My husband told me that Judd Apatow's big hero in his life was Gary Shandling.
That's right.
And so we watched Freaks and Geeks, which was a series that he did about his childhood. And sort of like there's a scene with one of the main characters, sort of a latchkey kid coming home and making himself a grilled cheese, and it's sort of sad, and then he turns on Gary Shandling and laughs so hard. It's one of the best things I've ever seen. I tweeted it if anybody wants to see it, a direct link. You can just go to my Twitter feed. My husband tweeted it, and then I retweeted it, and we watched it, and it's so good. Freaks and Geeks.
Yeah, it's been a long time. That show was on, like, was it? I feel like it was on, like,
in the 90s.
Yeah. And was
but
it
it's
on?
It's about the 80s.
Right.
And it has Jason, who are the actors in it? It has Seth
James Franco, Seth Rogen.
Launched the careers of everybody. And I mean, it was a big sort of short term, and it
only had one season.
Yeah.
And it is, and one of the guys who's the guy who sort of, I think it's Apatow's sort of character, and who watches the Gary Shandling piece, is on Silicon Valley, which is a series that I love.
Uh-huh.
And he's now on that. So it's all these great actors that now we watch all the time, and it was their first sort of TV show, and it's so good, and it's just beautiful and funny and teenagery and sort of coming of agey, and you know, some of them are freaks, some of them are geeks, and it's about this girl who kind of goes back and forth between them, and it's just beautiful. So
did you watch this with the kids? Your kids can watch anything at this point, right? I mean, there's nothing you don't show them.
Yes, it's just there because it really is coming of age. It's like it'll kind of kill you, Sam. Like you'll be like, oh, you know. And then so for kids, I'm on the radio. I'm on a real radio live. Thomas just asked me for earphones, and I'm gonna have to put them on right now. Say hello to all of America.
Hello, America.
Hello, Thomas. How are you?
Hello, good. You?
I'm doing well. It's great to hear your voice, buddy.
Good to hear yours.
You remember Mila?
Well, here's my mom.
You remember Mila?
Mila? No, not really.
From you guys were in that you were in the play together. Didn't you guys do that after school play? She used to go to 87, buddy.
Oh yeah.
You found her a little bit pushy, I think. I think you told your mom.
Nah.
A little bit. I mean, I understand. She is. I've trained her that way.
Okay.
All right.
I have to give you your mom.
Great talking to you.
Yeah. Bye.
Great talking.
That was his punishment for interrupting me.
Yeah. Well, I took him to task. I made him admit.
What did you say?
I made him admit that he said that Mila was a little pushy. For people who don't know, Isabel's sons and my daughter used to go to the same elementary school for a couple of years. And Mila and Thomas, I think, is a year older than Mila, were in a production together of Any Which Way You Can or something like that, I think it was. And I think Thomas reported to Isabel that Mila was a little bit pushy. And I was not shocked by that at all.
It was a production of, what was it, a production of, Thomas?
Any Which Way You Can.
I think it was Shakespeare, wasn't it?
No, it was Any Which Way You Can, I think. Something like that. It was like
I thought it was Shakespeare.
No.
That's hilarious. That is so funny. Yeah, Thomas doesn't deal with pushy women.
Well, what?
How did it go with Mila the other day?
Oh, well, I'm not going to tell.
Lunch situation?
What's that? Oh, yes, I know what you're talking about. Yeah, no,
we're not going to go there.
I don't want to do that.
No, you're right. You're right. It's a temptation not to just talk about your kids constantly, even in a public venue, because you kind of forget.
I mean, I'll complain about him, but I won't give like a running play-by-play as to what Mila is doing these days.
No, I know. And it's boring anyway, right?
Well,
who cares? Everybody has kids.
Right. It's true. Although your kid was very, was great on air. He was very, very composed. definitely felt like he was uncomfortable being on. Although he did say hello to America, and America waved back. I didn't say anything.
Back to Freaks and Geeks.
So Freaks and Geeks.
Because I never even really understood Gary Shandling very much, because I think he's sort of like Philip Roth. He's a little like a sort of male. I feel very male. What do you think? Kelly, you want to chime in? Do you have any thoughts about that?
I've never thought that before. I'd have to rewatch to evaluate that. I know what you mean by I agree about Philip Roth, but I'm not sure. I haven't seen the Gary Shandling show or the Larry Sanders show.
I could be wrong
too,
but that's why I think I never really got it. And so then we went down deep into Freaks and Geeks. I think you guys should too. It's just sort of wonderful.
Well, Freaks and Geeks. If anyone hasn't
I'm going to have Milo watch it.
If anyone hasn't heard of it before, it only has one season.
Yeah, that's
but
right.
It is really good. And I Wikipedia'd it just to see who all was on it. And it's pretty ridiculous.
The amount of stars.
The amount of stars. I mean, not just the stars, but then there's one episode that has, and this is, you know, before, I mean, Leslie Mann is in it, is in this episode. Judd Apatow's wife.
Okay.
Or his, I mean, I don't think they were married then, but Ben Stiller, Jason Schwartzman, Shia LaBeouf.
If it's all, am I losing you?
No.
Am I losing you?
I think in a moment.
Okay. But...
And Jason Segel and Busy Phillips were the main character. It's really.
All right. So a lot of people in Freaks and Geeks.
Okay,
people should
Sam.
Watch it. People should watch it. I don't know the
people
names
should watch it, and it was inspired. He was inspired by Gary Shandling, so it's a little tip of the hat up to heaven and of comedy, and that's what I got on the way to DC.
All right, well, Isabel, have a great weekend. Send some pictures. Send some pictures.
Happy
of the,
Easter to everybody who celebrates.
Happy Easter to all the Gentiles. I think we have three
Where
or four
would
that
I
will
send,
listen to the show.
Where would I ever send a picture? To you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, send it to me.
All right. All right. I will. I'll send a picture from maybe the News Museum.
All right, great. Do that.
The
put
Newseum.
It up.
Museum.
Yeah.
We'll blur out your family.
Oh, so good. All right, listen. Everybody, peace. See you in April.
Train carefully.
Have a good trip.
All right, bye-bye.
This was a fun one. Okay, bye.
Bye. All right, ladies and gentlemen, Isabel Gillies, always a pleasure to have her on. Now, let's play the Jimmy Reefer Cake Song of the Week, ladies and gentlemen. The Jimmy Reefer Cake Song of the Week. What is the name of it, Matt?
The Vasectomy Loophole.
The Vasectomy Loophole. Okay.
It's not a religious objection to birth control. This is a requirement for vagina control. Gotta control that hole. They said sex for pleasure was a bad thing, so very shameful. But that's not if it falls within the Hobby Lobby vasectomy loophole. With a vasectomy and a bottle of Viagra, you have prepared your penis. And all the women who have sex with you will call you a genius. The ladies don't have to take the pill, but night and day their boots are knocking. Sex to enjoy with the vasectomy ploy, how very shocking. It's not a religious objection to birth control. This is a requirement for vagina control. Gotta control that hoe. So all the dudes got vasectomies, and the girls made a habit to sneak back into the Hobby Lobby storage room and do it like rabbits. Until a Dateline special revealed the greatest disgrace. There was genetic matter in the store all over the place. It was an outrage that spread from town to town, and every Hobby Lobby was finally shut down. It's not a religious objection to birth control. This is a requirement for vagina control. Gotta control that hole.
Wow. I feel like it, okay, folks, please. Okay, thank you. I feel like it was a reference to the Zubik case that was, where we heard oral arguments this week. It appears the Zubik case, at least this is by court watchers, that it will end up being 4-4, that Justice Kennedy, although he had said that his Hobby Lobby ruling was rather constrained and that the mechanism in which a Hobby Lobby would not be required to actually offer their employees an insurance plan that included contraception and birth control, that Kennedy had said at the time, the idea of them filling out a form will be fine. Now, apparently, he's finding that as being hijacking he used that term many times, hijacking the health insurance program of employers. So it appears, but you never know with these things, it could be a 4-4 decision, in which case it would only impact women living in Minnesota and maybe two or three other states, definitely two or three other states, I'm not exactly sure, in the Eighth Circuit. Of the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals had ruled that Zubik was okay. Maybe part of that is in the Pennsylvania area. And so that is my sense, probably around like the Pittsburgh environs. But it's possible. I'm looking up Eighth Circuit. So I'm not sure where the vasectomy comes into that. I'm not sure. But, I mean, sometimes, did he need it to rhyme? I'm not sure. I didn't, well.
No, I guess it's okay. I took the purpose to be that it's okay to have a vasectomy in the Catholic Church. I mean, that would make sense to me since I've gotten a little fired up over this whole Supreme Court case that if you're a man, whatever birth control method is available medically would probably be okay.
Well, you could probably also. Don't Catholics say it's okay to tie your tubes?
I don't know.
I have no idea.
Why would I know that? I don't know.
Wait, isn't that what happens with the females? I have no idea. Honestly, like I can't even contemplate any surgery in that area that's elective.
I know people.
I know people who've had it, and I just like no, thank you. As much as I don't want another child, no. No, sir. I can't even think about it. All right, ladies and gentlemen, let me just tell you, it's the end of the week. Michael has left because now his big thing is he likes to have three-day weekends. So he's like, I can't be bothered to come in on Friday, or if I come in, I'm just going to come in for a minute. Hopefully, he said to me, I'm coming in if you've made some coffee. I'm going to pick up a cup of coffee, and then I'm going to go. No, Michael left because he didn't feel well. So we told him to get out of here because we don't want to get sick. And he was just sitting around. It was a sad case. I should have taken a photo. He was sitting over there with like a cold compress on his head and getting his germ-infested fingers all over the microphone. And we were like, get out of here, man. He could have something like, he could have the plague. He was like, he was getting hives on him or something.
Gosh, what do you say about me when I'm not here? He had no hives. He just,
well,
not to bring up Michael's medical minute to the forefront again, but.
What kind of music would we put for that?
I don't know. Sad? He has a migraine again.
Yeah, was it a migraine?
That's what he said, yes. Which will make you sick in different ways, from my experience, he seemed to
it's horrible. Horrible.
Be nauseated more so than just the light and sound bothering him.
That song sounds like it would give you a migraine.
This is Dr. Mario. I thought it might be good. Oh. Michael's Medical Minute music.
The worst thing for it, this
the worst light
is sitting under these lights.
That's why I told him.
And then having noise directly into your...
I was just like, get out of here. He's like, I'm going to stay through Dayton. And I'm like, why?
He's trying to tough it out.
You know what? It was very sad.
He's a tough guy.
Low energy.
That likes to go to the spa.
Migraines are very... it's weak.
I like contributors who don't get migraines.
All right, folks, just a reminder, this show exists because of our members who support the show by contributing money and allowing us to do the free show every day, and also an extra, in some instances, it's a half hour. It's usually closer to like 90 minutes, but sometimes we try and land in between there. Today, we'll probably land somewhere in between there. At the break, we're going to go into the fun half. Today on the fun half, Alex Jones says that gangs of black youth singing Beyonce songs are telling people to get out of baseball fields. So we're going to examine what's behind that, because if that's true, it could impact the entire season. And you wouldn't want something like that going on. America's pastime. Can you believe it? And they're doing this in broad daylight, apparently, which is also odd because... it's March and the season hasn't even started yet. And I don't know what all these people are doing at a day game in early March. Maybe you can maybe the plan to do this in April. And we have a great clip of Ted Cruz getting so angry at that sniveling coward Donald Trump. And then Ted Cruz having a sort of like hem and ha. It's enjoyable. We got a weird clip of a guy in a Lyft. It's like an Uber service. It's Lyft in Salt Lake City.
Why are you telling all the clips in a row? I'm just wondering.
I'm just teasing what we do in the fun half.
Yeah. It's kind of like I almost don't need to hear some of the clips.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. Wherein, apparently, there's no reason to be there. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. You get 10% off. Folks, when you become a member, you get the show commercial free. So if you found some episodes this week annoying because there were two commercials, that's because you're not a member. And we get the first half of the show is commercial free when that happens, except for like when I say MajorityReportKickback.com. Buy your Amazon crap there or buy your quality Jet products at Jet.com. It's not actually Jet products. It's just, see you later.